It is Tuesday, May 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams reporting from Washington. Coming up, 11 Afghan policemen received prison sentences in the mob killing of a woman in March. We look at the expected role of foreign policy in the upcoming presidential campaign.
It's the state of the world right now. Republicans are seizing on the unrest around the world, on some of the difficulties that President Obama is having.
We explore the recent biker killings in Waco, Texas, and the popular TV show American Idol is finally coming to an end. It's all ahead. A court in Kabul has sentenced 11 police officers to one-year jail terms Tuesday over the deadly mob beating of a woman in the Afghan capital earlier this year. The judge found the 11 officers guilty of neglecting their duty to protect 27-year-old Farkunda from the brutal March 19th attack that was sparked by false accusations she desecrated the Muslim holy book, the Quran. Cell phone video showed people beating her with sticks, pushing her body from a rooftop and running it over with a car before dragging the body through the streets of Kabul, burning it and dumping it in the river. The attack sparked protests in Afghanistan and widespread outrage elsewhere, including condemnations by Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and the United Nations. 30 civilians and 19 police officers were arrested and charged with either participating in the attack or failing to stop it. Earlier this month, the court had sentenced four of those civilians to death, including the cleric Mullah Zanul Abedin. Eight others had been imprisoned for 16-year jail terms. We're joined now by VOA's Lina Ruzbe of the Afghan Service. Lina, what impact has this case had on Afghanistan and particularly on the country's women?
Well, without exaggeration, we can say that this is the first time in the history of Afghanistan where a group of women lifted the cascade of a disease and not men and carried that to the graveyard. Because traditionally in a society, Islamic tradition society such as Afghanistan, it's the job of men and it's only permitted for the men to lead prayers and carry cascades of the disease to the graveyard. That it's in itself draw a lot of attention to that gathering. And surprisingly, the woman who participated that told us that they didn't do they do it out of conscious at the moment when they gathered there. It wasn't something that they plan ahead. And they were supported by a man who participated in that funeral of Farkhunda as well. And then the next day, when there was a call for a protest in front of Supreme Court, everybody thought that, okay, maybe 10, 20 women will appear. And probably it's like they did protest against Sharia law a year ago, and they won't be a big population present in front of the Supreme Court. But to the surprise of everybody, it was raining. It was not a pleasant weather either, but hundreds of women with placards from every walks of life, I mean, from a housewife to a civil society activist to a professor to a doctor, they gathered in front of Supreme Court and they carried slogans, placard with slogans such as, "We are Farkhunda, we want justice. The government need to serve justice for Farkhunda." And also men who they were carrying placards with slogans such as, "We are ashamed that we could not save you, that we are your brother." So that in itself, in a society where he's speaking against mullahs, speaking about anybody who's associated in one way or another to the religion of Islam, whether they're doing the right thing or misinterpreting the religion, is a very tough thing. And also doing it from a woman's point of view, by a woman, it was really unprecedented. And the Afghan woman proved that they will not be taking this anymore.
Yeah, this has made a very deep impact upon them. Well, I believe that earlier today you interviewed Farkhunda's brother. What was his reaction to the events?
We did a Skype interview with him right after the verdict of the court was delivered this morning in Kabul. He was not happy about the verdict. He said that the justice was partially or adequately served in the case of his sister, and that him and his family member were not invited to the hearing today, and that they were not happy about that. And he also mentioned that four of the individual perpetrators whom were seen in the video doing the most harm to Farhunda, they beat her, and also one of them ran the car over her body and dragged her body to the river. Somehow their name were announced at the beginning of the trial by the judge, but none of them were present at the court and in none of the hearing, and somehow, according to him, they disappeared into thin air. But he said he would like to thank every Afghan in Afghanistan and outside who stood by the family during such a rough and tough time, and they raised their voice for Farhunda, for justice, and supported the family greatly, because unfortunately in a traditional society like Afghanistan, even in cases like that where a woman is victim, still there is this portrayal of shame that come across, comes on the family, and the families hold responsible more than people who commit this kind of crimes. And for Farhunda's family, they are grateful for the support that they received and that they were given an opportunity to openly speak about their pain and everything that happened to Farhunda.
Now, I believe in addition, you spoke with a civil rights activist about the events. What was his opinion about the results?
He too, as a member of civil society, said he's not happy about the verdict, but he said, let's look at it this way. There were times in Afghanistan not long ago, I mean, that people could get away with crimes like that, killing people in public. And also, there are some people who get arrested for such crimes, but they can buy their way out with money and power. If they have influential people who are related to them, they can free them from jail. So by going through this process, in a way, Afghanistan proved that, yes, we are a newly democratic society. We are taking very baby steps toward the rule of law, toward ensuring that justice is being served. And the fact that two trials took place, some got convicted to death, the others to jail, and the fact that 19 police were brought before law in itself proves that Afghanistan is going toward the right path, although it's not justice as we perhaps believe in Western society, but it is the beginning for Afghanistan, and that it will eventually get better and better for future incidents such as this one. Yeah.
Yes, thank you very much. That is Lena Ruzba. Well, looking at getting into our social media segment, Michael Lipman, what are people saying about this case in Afghanistan on social media?
Thanks, Sarah. We do have an article about the sentencing of the Afghan police on our website. It was published today, May 19th, and it's by our Islamabad correspondent, Ayesha Tanzim, titled 11 Afghan Police Sentenced to Prison Over Lynching. We already have one comment posted at the bottom of that article. It comes from Gene in the southern U.S. state of Texas. He writes, "Bravo for Afghanistan convicting a Muslim cleric to death for causing the death of this woman by bearing false witness against her." Well, feel free to share your opinions as well. Just go to the bottom of the article and find the comments box. Now, BBC television news anchor Caddy Kay, who's based here in Washington, she also tweeted about this story today. She was more critical of the sentences handed down to the Afghan officers. Using her account at Caddy Kay BBC, she said, "Only 1 year in prison for Afghan police who stood by as Farhunda was beaten to death and then burned." Well, that tweet drew several responses, including one from Twitter user at ValerieNoel68. That user wrote, "What a travesty of justice for Farhunda. Police officers are supposed to protect and serve and enforce the law, and they failed miserably." Well, in terms of how much this story is resonating on Twitter, internet analytics website Topsy says there have been more than 1,200 tweets mentioning the name Farhunda in the past 24 hours. Well, you can also send us your thoughts on Twitter. You can reach me at Michael_Lipin, spelled L-I-P-I-N. Sarah?
Yes, thanks very much, Michael.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Please look at our website, voanews.com.
Here's the news. Shiite militias massed Tuesday outside the Iraqi city of Ramadi ahead of a possible offensive to try to recapture the Anbar provincial capital from Islamic State militants. A court in Kabul has sentenced 11 police officers, including a district police chief, to one-year jail terms Tuesday, while setting eight others free over the deadly mob beating of a woman in Kabul earlier this year. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says he is planning a Thursday visit to a factory park that lies just north of the demilitarized zone that separates North and South Korea. The United Nations is intensifying pressure on Southeast Asian governments that have been reluctant to come to the rescue of refugees and migrants stranded at sea following a crackdown on human traffickers. And former Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat has appeared in court to face criminal charges over a mismanaged rice subsidy program. I'm Bob Doty, VOA News.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, the TV show American Idol is coming to an end. That'll be sad news for a number of people. And now, this look at U.S. politics.
Foreign policy issues are dominating the early stages of the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign. And national correspondent Jim Malone is here with a look at the issue. Welcome, Jim. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Susan.
Say, Americans often think of their own personal needs when it comes to the elections. You know, the economy, health care, that sort of thing. Why is foreign policy so important this time around?
It's the state of the world right now. Republicans are seizing on the unrest around the world, on some of the difficulties that President Obama is having with his foreign policy. And don't forget the top Democratic contender is Hillary Clinton, who was Barack Obama's Secretary of State. So they're going to try to pin some of these foreign policy difficulties or failures, depending on your point of view, on her.
Well, do these candidates really have any experience with foreign policy? You think of them mostly as a national issue.
A lot of them are governors. Some do have experience. For example, take Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. He's going to announce soon that he's officially running. For all intents and purposes, he already is. He said the other day he's running now because the world is falling apart. Lindsey Graham is closely aligned with John McCain in the Senate, sort of a conservative voice advocating stronger U.S. military presence around the world, ground troops if necessary in the Middle East to counter the Islamic State. So he's running specifically because of national security concerns.
Well, you mentioned Hillary Clinton. Does the importance of foreign policy right now, does this give her an edge up, an inside lane?
Well, the Democrats think it does. They don't think she can be attacked as inexperienced because of her tenure as Secretary of State. On the other hand, Republicans will seize what happened in Benghazi in 2012, the attacks there on the U.S. missions while she was Secretary of State. And they'll point to other problems with the Obama foreign policy. But, you know, I think for Hillary Clinton, her drive at the moment is trying to secure progressives in the Democratic Party. She doesn't want anybody on the left sneaking up on her. So her focus is making sure Democratic liberals are happy as they march toward the nomination.
Well, the economy is doing pretty good. Not great, but pretty good. Do you think this is going to be the front issue all the way through the voting?
It usually is. At the end of the day, it's how people feel about the economy, how they feel about where the country is headed. And even some Democratic pollsters, by the way, point out a lot of people aren't happy. They want some change. The trick for Hillary Clinton is going to be, I can be the agent of change even though I was part of the Obama administration. Republicans will have a different argument. They say after 8 years of President Obama, it's time for real change, and they're going to offer it. The interesting thing is, of course, on the Republican side, we don't know who's going to emerge as the nominee. It's going to be really fascinating to watch a large field battle one another for many, many months.
Well, thank you for your insight. As always, Jim, appreciate it. And come by again real soon and share your thoughts.
Always here. Happy to do it.
Thank you, Jim. That's national correspondent Jim Malone with us today.
And that was Susan Yaki, and my thanks to her as well as to Jim Malone. Well, now, a clash between rival motorcycle gangs in Waco, Texas, Sunday left 9 people dead and nearly 20 injured in one of the worst shootouts in recent U.S. history. The incident has focused attention on so-called biker gangs. As VOA's Greg Flakes reports from Houston, law enforcement officials say they pose a great threat to public safety.
Police say the big shootout in Waco was a clash between members of a large Texas-based gang called the Bandidos and members of smaller gangs, one of which is called the Cossacks. Investigators recovered more than 100 guns on the scene and arrested about 170 people, according to Waco police spokesman Sergeant Patrick Swanton.
I will tell you that in 34 years of law enforcement, this is the worst crime scene, the most violent crime scene that I have ever been involved in.
Swanton says authorities knew the gangs were assembling in Waco and tracked their movements closely, having a unit on hand at the restaurant to take action if a fight broke out.
We were extremely fortunate to have our best, most well-trained officers here, and that was our tactical unit. They were here for the specific reason of we knew there was going to be trouble at this biker event.
Swanton says the gang members also fired at police, but no one other than gang members was wounded or killed. Federal and state authorities say the 2,000-member Bandidos gang is involved in drug smuggling and other types of organized crime. The gang formed in South Texas in the 1960s and now has affiliated chapters around the United States and in several other countries. Sociology professor James Quinn at the University of North Texas, who has studied biker gang group dynamics, says the character of gang chapters varies.
So you have a chapter with some guys that are fairly sophisticated and pretty into organized crime. You can have another chapter that is more on the misfit, just riding, drinking, carousing types. And sometimes you get a bit of both.
Quinn says men also join these gangs for various reasons.
A lot of them are looking for excitement and camaraderie. You've got other people that are looking for opportunities to launch organized crime.
Quinn and other experts on gangs say members are bound by an oath of loyalty to defend any member who is threatened by an outsider. The primary rivals of the Bandidos are members of the even larger California-based gang known as the Hells Angels. Both have international affiliates, and there have been violent clashes between them in Australia, Western Europe, and Canada, according to Julian Scher, a Canadian journalist who has written 2 books about the biker gangs.
More than 160 people were killed, most of them biker gang members, but some civilians. When the Bandidos and the Hells Angels fought it out in the streets of the province of Quebec, the Bandidos and the Hells Angels fought it out in Europe for control of the drug trade there. So the Bandidos have a long history of violence.
Scher says there may be a lull in violence following the Waco shooting, but he says eventually the gangs will clash again.
The image of the biker gangs really never changes. This is what they're about. This is their very nature. And it was just pure luck that there were no innocent people killed in that shootout, but there have been cases where innocent people have been killed.
Most of the people arrested in Waco are members of the Bandidos, and authorities there remain concerned that other members could come to town and clash with members of rival groups who are still in the city. Both Texas state investigators and federal agents are on the scene to assist in the investigation of the crime, and authorities say they have taken precautions to deal with any further disruption of the peace. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Millions of faithful viewers in the United States are about to go through withdrawal as the popular American Idol is scheduled to end. My colleagues David Byrd and Larry London discuss.
Right now, he's probably slow dancing with a bleach blonde tramp, and she's probably getting thirsty.
It was a groundbreaking program when it first started, but now American Idol's run is coming to an end. The program, which has launched the careers of such well-known artists as Carrie Underwood and other singers, has now decided that, well, maybe it's time to call it a day. Joining me in the studio is Ray McDonald. Ray, why exactly is American Idol ending?
American Idol is ending, Dave, for the simple reason that it doesn't attract nearly the number of viewers that it used to. And the Fox network decided that it's time to pull the plug.
Now, this launched the career of Kelly Clarkson, Carrie Underwood, as we mentioned, a couple of very, very famous artists. But they've got some competition. It seemed like there were a lot of clones of this show. You've got The Voice, which is on another network, as they say, which is a similar judging format. Then you have The X Factor, which was started by the man who basically came up with American Idol, which is Simon Cowell. But
Simon Cowell was Mr. American Idol. I mean, he was the driving force behind the show. He was sort of the man we love to hate, and he was a huge reason why American Idol was the most popular show on American television for most of its run.
And now that popularity has waned because, partially because of some of this competition, and also, you know, 15 years is a long time for a TV show.
Well, American Idol went on the air in 2002. It was a spinoff of Pop Idol, which was a British talent competition, and Simon Cowell came with it. And the original judging lineup was Simon, Paula Abdul, who was a former choreographer and singing star, and Randy Jackson, who was a longtime studio pro. And these three had a special kind of chemistry that the viewers absolutely loved. And it was like seeing family members. So twice a week, Americans tuned in to see these three go at it. And at first, I think the performers were sort of incidental to it. But the very first American Idol champ, Kelly Clarkson, became the most popular of all of them worldwide. Carrie Underwood, who I believe was the fourth season champion, is the bestseller here in the United States. And then you have several other big names.
Fantasia
Barrino, Jennifer Hudson.
It's a program that has got a lot of clones. I mean, you mentioned that it was originally Pop Idol in Britain. Mm-hmm. Well, there was Britain's Got Talent. Now there's America's Got Talent. And then, you know, the Dancing with the Stars is the same kind of format. You've got, you know, judges judging a performance and people being sent off and all this kind of stuff.
Well, one reason American Idol was so popular in its first few years was that it was the only game in town. It really didn't have too many clones in the early years of the 2000s.
All right. Well, that is Ray McDonald. If you'd like to comment on this, please let us know by logging on to our Facebook page. You can send us an email. We're also on Twitter.
This is my heartbeat song, and I'm going to play it. Been so long, I forgot how to turn it up, 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 up all night long. Up, up, all night.
I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for listening to International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Never put all your eggs in one basket, advises an old proverb. Do not risk all your resources by trusting just one provider. Diversify. This is particularly important when dealing with indispensable resources such as energy. Europe learned that the hard way in early January 2009, when a pricing dispute between Russia and Ukraine escalated, leading to a halt in Russian gas exports to Europe and Ukraine. For 13 days, gas deliveries for Bulgaria, Greece, Macedonia, Romania, Croatia, and Turkey was totally cut off. Bulgaria, Greece, and Macedonia were especially vulnerable because they bought almost all of their gas from Russia and did not have an alternative source of supply. Following this incident, the European Union began a push to diversify its energy sources. Today, Greece is looking to leverage its strategically important position at the southern tip of the Balkan Peninsula when it constructs the Trans-Adriatic Pipeline, or TAP, facilitating and also using Azerbaijani gas en route to Italy. Greece is also considering whether to host the Turkish Stream pipeline that would carry Russian natural gas currently routed through Ukraine to Turkey and beyond. While Russia is an important supplier of energy to Europe, construction of Turkish Stream will not increase Europe's energy security, said U.S. State Department Special Envoy and Coordinator for International Energy Affairs, Amos Hochstein, during a recent visit to Greece. The best way for Greece to diversify its supply and increase its energy security is by supporting the Trans-Adriatic Pipeline, which will carry Caspian natural gas from Azerbaijan. Additionally, work has already begun on the Trans-Adriatic Pipeline. The Trans-Adriatic Project fulfills that trifecta of what is energy security. New source, new supply, new route, said Special Envoy Hochstein. And it's not a single country that is dominating the infrastructure and the gas production. It's many companies, different consortiums, different countries. No one element can bring it down or use it as leverage, he said. As Special Envoy Hochstein commented, diversification is ultimately the best way to create security of supply. TAP provides that diversification.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.